From Edge Radio 99.3 FM, this is an edit of The Dice Men Cometh, the podcast.
The Dice Men Cometh!
You know, I was standing in line today at the hamburger stand when a Buddhist monk came up and said, "Can you make me one with everything?" But you know, it's hard to explain puns to kleptomaniacs because they take things literally. You're with The Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. I'm Mark.
I'm sorry, everyone. And Garth. And we have a special inverted commas guest with us tonight.
Yo, mofos, game on. It's Trent here back in the studio to kick ass and chew bubblegum. And you know, when you're eating Doritos like most gamers with bubblegum, that's a strange taste sensation that I don't necessarily recommend. Hello.
Wow, you and Mark have really prepared your intros tonight. What are we talking about this week? We are going to talk what we have been playing, which of course is something that everyone knows and loves. We are then going to talk about horror on the Orient Express, which will lead us quite nicely into Trent's GM tips, because he has been GMing and or DMing for about 57 years, which is great. We will then hopefully get a bit of an update on how the man cave is progressing, because we didn't talk about that a while back. And then we've got some other stuff if we run out of time, which we won't.
So it sounds like Trent's going to talk about quite a lot of stuff.
Exactly right. That's what better way to kick off episode 112 on the 7th of April.
Well, you know what I say when Trent talks? Don't believe a word. Oh, that voice of the amazing, dearly departed Phil Lynott with Thin Lizzy there. Don't believe a word on Edge Radio 99.3 FM with the Dice Men Cometh, Mark and Garth, and special guest in the studio, Trent.
It's amazing that you actually segued into a song I kind of dug for once.
Of course.
Well, it's of your generation.
You're surprised. Not normal. Now, Trent, you shut up.
I heard you, Garth. You shut up.
No, hang on, Trent. You shut up.
Oh. Because, no, everybody shut up.
No, you shut up, because Garth is going to tell us, talk about what we, as in he and I, because we don't invite you, what we've been playing lately.
That's true. However, Trent and I did have a secret game last night, which Mark was not invited to.
What are we talking about?
I don't know. We are going to talk about Scoville.
Oh, yes.
Which is a game by Tasty Minstrel,
oh,
who are
God.
One of, it must be said, the most generous game companies that we've had any dealings with, because Scoville joins what is now a very long list of games that we have been very generous. I say it wrong every time. They've given it to us to review, which is absolutely wonderful. So thank you again, Mike Mindy's and TMG Games. That is fantastic.
Their generosity abounds.
It sure does. So we're talking Scoville, which is designed by Ed Marriott. Originally released in 2014, but obviously did pretty well because we've got the second edition that was printed this year. So that has been fantastic. This is a 2-6 player, 60 to 90 minute game, which actually plays in the time it says on the box from Woo-hoo. Our experience, which is awesome.
Take that, Fantasy Flight!
And as the name suggests, Scoville, it's about chilies.
Because Scoville is the unit of measurement for the hotness of chilies.
It is. Correct. So let me give you guys a little history lesson, because Wilbur Scoville was born on the 22nd of January 1865. He developed a test mark that you may be interested in. It is called a Scoville organoleptic test, Ooh. Which is used to measure the hotness of peppers. It's still used, even though he designed that test in 1912, so it's just celebrated its centenary, which is fantastic.
Organoleptic.
I know.
You taste it.
Indeed. Make it sound more scientific. So anyway, the premise of this game is that you are in the town of Scoville, and every year the town of Scoville has a competition to see which are the best, i.e. the hottest chilies or the peppers around. They have a festival which includes auctions, it has a farmer's market, of course it has a chili cook-off so you can all compete to see who's got the best chilies. And of course, like every festival, everyone's vying for victory points. So this game, again, is determined whoever has the most victory points is going to be the chili winner. Now, It's rare, it's outrageous, but this method works with this kind of game because we are talking about what would arguably be a medium weight Euro worker placement where it's a very, very simple game to explain. Having now explained it to Mark a couple of weeks ago and Trent last night, we were able to get an explanation and a two and three player game played in about an hour and a half, which is great.
Yeah,
it's not exactly a worker placement game, though. It's a chili placement game.
Yes.
But yes, it's in that sort of Power Grid, Puerto Rico, dare I say even Lewis and Clark space as a Euro.
Mm.
Because, yeah, you're juggling your resources, but it's a race to grab points.
It is.
And you've got to be the first to plant certain kinds of chilies, fill the recipes or meet orders from the market. So speed and efficiency and managing your resources correctly is what you need to
definitely
do.
Definitely. Now, this game plays really quick. It's very simple to teach. You start by having an auction. Everyone blind bids, and they can bid anywhere zero up to the maximum number of coins that you might have. Now, that leads us to turn order, because turn order in this game is crucial because of the following steps. Because after auction, you're going to have the planting where everyone gets to plant one and only one chili. Now, there are about 8 to 10 different coloured chilies in this game. So what you plant is going to be really important and where, because the next phase after planting is harvesting. Now, unlike planting, which goes around in turn order from one through to up to six players, harvesting is done in the reverse order, and harvesting is done when you basically will have your little farmer meeple or farm meeple walk between two chilies of whatever colours you've planted. So, simply put, a red and a yellow chili next to each other, if you walk between them, you will get an orange chili, which again makes sense. It also comes with a really nice, relatively simple to read player aid, so that you can start to plan your moves and know, well, I'm going to get an orange chili and a brown chili, and oh, I'm going to get one of those ghost chilies if I manage to make this move happen before Mark blocks that path, which I need.
And sometimes you want to plant chilies first, and other times you want to harvest
chilies
first. Mark, did you find in your game that you spent the whole time just agonizing over what you wanted to do first?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I...
And because there's a bidding mechanic and just half the game is just sitting there going, oh, what do I want to do?
And I think, and look, you know, spoiler alert, Garth won the game that I played in with Garth and Carl. And a lot of the time I had chosen to go, I'd bid the most money and I'd chosen to go last for that harvesting phase.
Yep.
And I think looking back at how Garth just beat me, it was that mix of things of getting those auction cards first that you haven't mentioned yet.
Mm-hmm.
And also getting first access to those chili recipes.
That's right. So, yeah, part of the benefit of being the first player is that you will win the auction. Now, there's always going to be a certain number of auction cards equal to the number of players. So everyone who's playing is going to get a reward, which is always going to be some combination of chilies that you'll just pick up for free. But the more important thing is after you've done your harvesting, which happens in reverse player order, you then get to go to the fulfillment stage, which is essentially where you're going to earn all your victory points, because the fulfillment stage is made up of three parts. You can go and visit the farmer's market, which is very simply a number of cards where you cash in a number of chilies that meet the criteria on the card. The card might say, I want a green chili and a purple chili. For that, you will get a black chili, $4, and a victory point.
Mm.
So you've got the opportunity to do that. The next one is you've got to be able to go to the recipes, and there's again going to be a certain number of recipe cards available, which are just a slightly more complicated version of the farmer's market cards.
Yeah, anything they will from say, sort of like three chilies up to some of them had eight or nine chilies,
every
whole bunch
possible
of different
chili
colours
in the game, and they will be worth a sliding scale of victory points from 3 up to 24 or 25 points. Now, considering that in the games we've played, scores have been hovering between mid-60s to mid-70s, getting one of those recipe cards that's worth 20-plus points is massive.
Yeah.
So that's really, really important because the first player gets to have first dibs on doing all of those things. The last thing you get to do in that fulfillment stage is sell any of your chilies that you've got in your behind your little player aid. And the price of those is determined by how many pairs of chilies of the same colour that you're selling are already planted. And it's very, very simple. But you'll get a bit of money, which, look, $3 is worth a victory point. It's more about getting some cash to bid.
But then going first in the harvesting is really important as well, because it's a grid of chilies that you're, little wooden chilies that you're punching into these holes that are pre-cut in the board.
Which is great.
And the farmers are just moving around in sort of straight lines and they can't move backwards, and there's a couple of little rules to know there. But it's a really tactical little move where moving in between two chilies that have been planted gives you the crossbred version of that. But it also helps you block your opponents.
Yes.
And if you can go first in that, and it's not a mechanic that I've really quite encountered before.
Yeah, and in our game, I was the only person to ever plant, to ever get a ghost chili, because I went between a black and a white chili, which gives you the ghost chili, which is this amazing translucent chili.
That's the top level chili.
Yeah,
yes.
And I got the clear one, and then did I actually plant it? No, I think I sold it or I did something with it. And then the next turn I went first again in the harvesting.
Yep.
And basically did it again and blocked that exact spot. So no one can ever get one.
Cashed in one of your three bonus cards, which are essentially once per game use, where instead of your farmers moving up to three spots, you moved four for that one time, blocking us. It was the last turn of the game, so you were a bastard. Didn't matter because
I love that mechanic because, you know, that is the only way you can get those ones. And the rarer ones, obviously, are worth a lot more. A lot of the recipes use the rarer ones. You get the shields. I don't know if you mentioned those, where if you're the first person to plant a particular colour of chili, you get a shield which gives you some victory points. And I had got a lot of those, but you had got a lot of the selling the chilies and the recipes. Was that juggling act that I love, where there's lots of ways to get victory points during the game? So, I don't know. I mean, are we allowed to talk about what we thought of it yet?
Well, I think so, but I really enjoyed the fact that every turn you were able to make a clear decision, do I want to go all in and bid for my first player? Because when you're bidding money, you're virtually bidding victory points, because $3 equals 1 point. But it's worth spending 5 or even 10 victory points worth of money if you know you're going to become first player and be able to use the chilies that you've got to buy the recipe cards or the market cards. And conversely, it's worthwhile to bid a lot to be able to go last and harvest that elusive black chili, white chili, or ghost chili.
I really enjoyed the fact that I won a game that I played against Garth last night. It was just the two of us. So seeing as Garth beat you previously, Mark, it's a lot like I have beaten you in a game. But I don't like to crow about it. The sting in the tail for this one, or the sting in the ring, if you like, is the AP potential.
Yes.
The analysis paralysis, because you're forever deciding whether or not you want to go first in the turn or if you want to harvest first. And you're consulting also the cheat sheet of chili genealogy that you get given, which is the crossbreeding chart, how to mix the colours to produce what it is you need, especially those elusive black and white chilies that then go on to combine and make the ghost chilies. This game plays up to 6, and I would be terrified of the AP with that amount. And I think if you just brought in a timer just to move things along, you could kind of get around that.
I think we should make that a rule for every game. So? but you're right. And I, at the time, I commented a lot about, oh, my God, there are certain people I'd never want to play this game. Because,
John.
With the recipes, with the wanted lists, and with the actual harvesting in the field, there's so many little decisions you can make. On one hand, I'd love to see with 6. I'd love to see what the chili field looks like, where it's absolutely chock-a-full of chilies, because everyone has to plant at least one chili.
So your game with 3, did the chili field fill up?
No.
Because we weren't even half full in our
two. No, I would have said it's probably filled like a third of the middle. Maybe that's about it.
What amazed me was just how important going first or second was, even in a two-player game.
Yes.
That decision got quite
intense. I agree. And we probably spent 2 to 3 minutes agonising over the bid that we're going to put in between two of us, even though we probably knew, well, one of us is going to bid 0, and just so that at least another person's getting rid of some hard-earned dollars.
And look, this game reminded me a bit of Fresco. I don't know if you've played Fresco, Trent. I know Garth hasn't, where you're painting the roof of the Sistine
Chapel. You're going to mix colours as well,
and you're mixing colours. So it has the colour mixing where you start off and you can only access blue, red, and yellow paint, and then you gradually get the more complex paints and are able to do more things. And instead of making chili recipes, you're applying paint to the roof of the Sistine Chapel. Quite similar, but I must say I liked Scoville better. And I look, I guess we're lucky in that we don't have that AP-prone person where we've got a almost like an inbuilt timer of, you know what, I've spent long enough on this, I've just got to make a decision. Sometimes.
Shall I point out the irony of who it is that's actually saying?
Well, look, I must say, in the game we played a week or so ago, Mark, and this was with Carl as well, who does happen to have an occasional moment of AP, it really only came to a head when we knew it was the final round.
Yes.
And that's where the typical game arenas is all about, how do I maximise my last turn? And that was where that round dragged on a little bit. But overall, we still played it in under 2 hours with three players, considering it was a learning game, and that included the rules explanation.
Yeah.
And then for you and I last night, Trent, it was an hour and a half at most, I'd reckon.
That included instructions, so...
And setup, yeah. And breakdown, which, with so many little chilies, can be a bit of a nuisance, so it's certainly a game you want to be able to package up nicely.
And, well, look, we did talk about the dilemma of, you know, we're now getting sent some games, and we want to be able to give a fair dinkum idea of what they're like. In this case, though, it's an absolute joy to report that this game that we were sent, it is, I loved it. I thought it was a fantastic game.
Yep. It's rated about 511, I think, on Board Game Geek. It should be higher. It's underrated, this game, and I hope the second edition gets it up there a little bit, because you talk about enjoying Euros, but wanting a more refreshing theme rather than I'm running an agrarian feudal medieval economy in Europe and I have a beard and look very serious.
Into the distance, I look out on the board.
So this is a Euro with a fun, irreverent theme that still has crunchy thinking that you're going to do. And agonising decisions. It's great. It's a great game.
And look, let's talk about how it looks.
Yep, fantastic.
Absolutely amazing. Mm. The little chilipals, the board, the cards, the colour palette. I loved it all. Oh, except the red chilies are brown.
Even though the red farm meeple is bright red. Yeah. So I don't know whether our version just has a little bit of an off colour on it.
Were you? Because I'm a little bit blue-green colourblind. And did you have a thing?
Well, it's funny because both Garth and Carl commented that they've never known me to have a thing with colours. But in this game, I did have a thing where I was struggling with the orange, the red, the brown,
the purple,
particularly on the recipe cards. Yeah, they sort of blended a bit. Maybe I'm just getting old.
Yeah, I think it's a very subjective thing, but it's a small gripe in what is a fantastic game, and that shouldn't put you off.
Yep. So look, yeah, I agree. This game is awesome. It fills a really nice niche. It is a thinky Euro that plays in a really small amount of time compared to those 3 and 4 hour epics that you can have. Well done by Ed Marriott and the guys at TMG. It's a cracker.
It's so great to have the three of us in agreeance.
Huh.
That was Ben Harper. Lovely bit of cat gut strumming there with the three of us. And it is just the three of us here in the Edge Radio Studios, 99.3 FM. We are the Dice Men Cometh with our special guest, Trent, returning to his old chair.
The scene of the crime.
Yes, that's right. Now, not only have we been playing some amazingly, interestingly themed Euro games, but Garth, we've been indulging in some dice chucking, storytelling, gut giggling, horror humor, role playing.
I know. And I've got two words for you, Mark. Toot toot. Because we are talking horror on the Orient Express, run by friend and colleague Trent, who is right here, so we have to say good things about it, because this will be an episode that he has to listen to. So, I'm just going to give you a little recap, because the last time we talked about this, we were basically getting on the train. We had just barely survived a scenario in London whereby one of us had not survived, but that's okay. Toot toot, and all aboard the Orient Express as our investigators head for Constantinople to meet with Professor Smith's trusted colleague, Professor Demir, the only man said to be capable of destroying the cursed blood red fez.
Ah!
Meadowcroft, played by Mark.
Hello.
Me, playing Harold Worth, were joined by our new companion, the dashing and certainly not dead Captain Roderick, known previously to Miss Meadowcroft, Mark, from their long nights together in Afghanistan.
Oh, yes.
And we were also joined by another of Smith's associates, the money-hungry French Dr. Marcel Wave.
For a small fee.
Indeed. Now, why Smith would wish to send a doctor on a perfectly safe and uneventful journey across the continent became apparent when the investigators encountered a mysterious shadow creature whose deadly claws were dispelled by Amelia's quick thinking with a gas lamp.
Yes.
And that started us off on the adventure from Paris all the way through to Constantinople in what was yet another romping good adventure session of Horror on the Orient Express. And we have the GM here to talk about this from the GM side of things, as well as from us mere players in your play.
Although the correct terminology as far as the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game system goes is Keeper.
The Keeper.
The Keeper of Arcane Lore.
Wow.
Or Keeper for short, yes. So well, look, what's three sessions that we've played now?
Yes, and look, I must admit, going into this third session with some trepidation, because at the end of session two, Amelia, my character, had found herself with the dreaded blood red fez placed on her head.
Firmly ensconced on her noggin.
Unable to be removed and basically passed out under the effects of the fez. Now, we've seen people under the effects of the fez before. One of them died. One of them was near to death. I wasn't feeling really that this was going to be a promising episode for Amelia.
And this is where it's been great to actually have a red fez on the table. So, because I just happened to know somebody who had one. He's a bit of a Doctor Who aficionado. Mm-hmm. And borrowed it off him. And just sitting it in the middle of the table just to sit there quietly humming to itself as
and
it does
in the game. And watching us squirm as we try to avoid touching it every occasion. Oh, there's a packet of chips there. I'm just going to work my way around the fez. But it all came down to a luck roll.
Yes, or a unluck roll.
Yes.
An NPC had to inflict the fez on somebody, and it just happened to be probably my favourite player, Mark.
It's not a lady's hat.
And what's been really amusing is you trying to figure out how it is you're going to navigate your way around the Orient Express. You know, the Concorde of its day, you know, the very height of luxury. You're surrounded by Europe's gentry. And you're thinking, can I just comb my hair up over this fez that's stuck on my head? Or just wear a top hat or something?
Because there are a lot of other passengers who do wear fezes. And to see Amelia Meadowcroft walking around would incite a fair amount of suspicion.
Yes.
So, yes, Mark, Amelia spent a lot of this journey tucked away in your cabin.
Although, I did gain some extremely hard to come by Cthulhu mythos points, and if I don't die very shortly, they might turn into something interesting. But look, the highlight for me of this episode, you know, the whole thing for me was, okay, we've got some documentation, some ancient books and whatever about how to become a master of the fez. We know there is another master of the fez on the train who clearly has these thralls also in fezes around. Did I have the ability, the intestinal fortitude, the know-how to become a fez master, at least to stave off my death, which seemed to be only a matter of days away?
That's for sure.
And to have that moment where the gentleman, I can't remember his name, Mr. Myers, was it?
Yes.
Who had been under the effect of the fez and basically very close to death, come out and basically attack everyone in the passageway, taken over by the fez monster.
As an undead servitor of the fez.
That's right. Yes. And that moment when Amelia said, I'm going to try and take control of him as a master of the fez, a few dice rolls, lo and behold, Mr. Myers stopped in his tracks and just turned. And I thought to myself, I wonder if the keeper's having me on here and he's just about to rip my face off. But lo and behold, I took control And then the next thing was, what do I make this guy
what
do?
What do I do with my new toy?
And if I make it too obvious and I go anywhere near this other Fezmaster, the evil Fezmaster, and he wrests control of the minion back again, it could be the end for all of us. So all I could think of was, I'll command him to jump off the train. And lo and behold, he did.
And saved our lives.
Yeah.
Well, at least your life, probably.
And so now, who knows? I may even survive one more session. I mean, that's not ever guaranteed in a Cthulhu session. But
well, that was one of those great moments where a player does something that just surprises you, because there was I hadn't predicted that you would do that to my monster. But look, it was fine. It was a lovely little dramatic moment, and those are the kinds of moments that you're looking for when you're running a game,
yeah.
So especially a story-driven game like this one, because this isn't just a map of rooms with treasure that you're trying to pillage like a, you know, like an old school D&D campaign. This really is an unfolding story. There's stuff going on behind the scenes that you guys know nothing mm-hmm. about. You know, yes. There's people watching you, and I'm trying to keep track of what the bad guys are doing, let alone the NPCs on the train as well. It is, I mean, not to blow my own trumpet too much, but it is actually quite an effort to keep all the balls in the air. And which is why I've been a little bit worried, because we're just playing this opening scenario, and I bought the box in here, and like I showed you, $200
yes.
campaign, this The Horror on the Orient Express. There's four books in it. We're into the first adventure. It's taken 3 days
yep.
of 3 nights of play so far, and it's going to take a fourth to wrap it up.
Yes.
And I'm thinking, are we going too slow?
And no. I can categorically tell you the answer's no, because everyone is having a blast with this scenario.
You have to say that, seeing as I'm here.
No. Look, the pace of this has been thrilling. There's been hardly a quiet moment. And when it is, it's because we're head down, bum up, you know, in the books that we've uncovered along the way. Because so much of this is actually trying to understand what the hell is going on
here.
Yeah,
it's unlike any other game that I've run. It's not just procedural. It's not just, you know, moving through a map, as I said, like a video game or like Diablo or Gauntlet or something like that. It's investigative. You're unwrapping a story. You're peeling back the layers of the onion.
And even the getting to know on the train, the other people on the train that, you know, that we're eating our meals with, that we're interacting with.
Yeah.
The you know, Mrs. McGregor, the reporter. No, the suffragette mm-hmm. from
Scotland.
From Scotland, Edinburgh. And, you know, the Count from Moscow and the evil Fezmaster and his minions. Like, we actually have to build a relationship with these people, because we're on the train with them for a couple of days. We're sharing meals. We're trying to uncover information. We're trying not to give away information. So you're actually building relationships with these NPCs. It's not like an NPC walks up, you ask them a question, you fight them, you kill them, or we steal something from them, they go away. Like, they're there with us. And now, even that we've made it to Constantinople, and we're sort of starting to delve into this dark underbelly of the occult and what's going on in Constantinople, and players and ex-players, as in the local scene, not us players. The hint is that there's so much going on, and we're only just starting to touch the very, very edge of it. There's so much depth there, it feels
exactly
like.
Exactly right. And look, I just really enjoy that it is not just about, there's an NPC, he looked at me funny, I'm going to shoot him, and I'll probably be able to take a book or some loot from him, and then I'll rinse and repeat that. I love the fact that you really have to exercise your brain to try and figure out a mental solution to this puzzle, because this game is, if you pull a gun on the Orient Express, something bad's going to happen to you, because that's just not what people did.
Or he's here.
Exactly right. You would have your weapon taken away. You'd be put in the lockup. You could be disboarded at the next stop. There's a whole bunch of consequences that should rightly go along
yes.
with that. So the fact that we're trying to figure out how do we not draw attention to ourselves as characters on this train while getting to an endpoint or some sort of solution that we want, while working together, while having these challenges thrown at us by yourself, the keeper, Trent, it's just really engaging and really fun, and I'm looking forward to the next session.
Look, there is so much we could talk about this. Now, Garth, you and I have talked a lot about our experiences. Let's come back after a quick musical break, hear a bit more from Trent, And maybe you can give us some pearls of wisdom. We'll be right back.
Uh-oh.
And that is the last Shadow Puppets with Next to Me. You're with the Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3. Now, next to me is our Dungeon Master, Game Master, Keeper of the Secrets of Something Something Cthulhu, Trent, who's going to walk us through what it takes to be such an expert.
Oh my God.
At running these grand games.
I did have a think, actually. I think I've been all of those things you just called me at some point, because I grew up playing D&D. Toon as well, Steve Jackson games. The James Bond role-playing game. Oh my God.
Mm-hmm.
It was terrible. Hunter Planet, played a lot of that when I was a kid. More recently played quite a bit of, some Pathfinder, Cyberpunk 2020. You guys
don't know that one.
No. Did you ever play Traveller?
Played it, didn't run it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've obviously played a lot more systems than what I've actually run. Ran a couple of Star Wars games as well, with mixed success, I have to say. It was a bit flashy and bright and shiny at first, but the novelty of it wore off after a
while. Yeah, sometimes you just want to be able to roll dice and know what they mean.
Exactly.
Not spend 10 minutes going, what's that threat? Does that cancel out that thing? And it's, yes. I liked to like it.
But it's a funny thing, sitting here now in your 40s and still playing a hobby that you played as a kid,
yes,
and finding new things in it and finding it rewarding.
Yeah.
So,
but that's the nature of when you haven't got a board with pieces in front of you, you've got a series of rule sets, or basically you've got your imagination to work with, really. And surely that must be some of the enjoyment that you find from this, is being able to let the imagination run wild.
Partly, yes. It's a bit of a blessing and a curse. And I've put together a sort of top 10. And if you go, don't listen to me, there's all sorts of guides to being a GM or running RPGs online. This is just stuff that I try to do it.
All so right. Only 10 things?
Yeah.
All right. Is that all it is?
Well, yes.
You told us it takes hours and hours and hours of preparation, Trent.
Well, each thing takes 10 years to learn.
Well, point number one is to understand that it does take hours of time, and it's not something that everyone can actually do. For instance, Garth.
Yes.
I would be really interested in playing a game that you run right now. If you can find a system that appeals enough to you to want to spend hours and hours with it.
Yep.
But A, do you have the time, and do you have the disposition? Because the reality of running a game, especially like a Call of Cthulhu game, is that it's a lot like an office job. Okay? Shuffling bits of paper around, and not everybody is the kind of person who can do that. And there's no shame in not being that kind of person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So ask yourself, do you want to do it? I think it's the first thing.
And that is a really valid point, because, Trent, you are an over-preparer. At the best of times, I think it's pretty fair to say.
Oh, yes. Moi?
Exactly, as he has his very carefully double-spaced written notes in front of us. But clearly you do find enjoyment in the organisation and the preparation, because it then makes the whole running of the game that much more seamless. It makes, for us as players, the fact that there isn't going to be downtime because, aha, here's that bit of paper I knew you were searching for in the locked box, just there ready to go. So it pays massive dividends.
And then I look cool, you know, by comparison, as cool as I can look running an RPG.
Yeah. All right, number two.
That you need to know the rules, I think, goes without saying, but you should also know them well enough to be able to occasionally break them when you need to.
Yes.
And break them in confidence, knowing that you don't have to tell anybody.
That, I think, would be the big secret for if you're going to break the rules. You don't want to tell anyone that that's what you're doing.
Because the drama of the moment should be more important than sticking to any of the rules.
And so many times, my experience in probably typically a D&D type session is I do this, silence, DM rolling dice behind the screen. Okay. And it just that sort of break in the narrative just destroys any the feeling of the moment, you know, in the moment that you're there and everything's exciting.
Actually, I think I should just add a 2.1 to this as well. I don't roll. I don't like rolling my dice behind the screen. I like to roll them in front of the screen. Not everybody agrees with me on that, though. But that's just my thing.
But then I also love the fact that not every roll that you do actually means anything. I've learned that.
There is sure. that, yes. Number three, run some practice combats before you actually get in and start playing. And I'm guilty of actually not doing this, because combat's always the most intensive part yes. of running any RPG. So if you're learning a system, just get a couple of pre-gen characters and just run through it yourself. Get them to cast a few spells or bombs or whatever other, you know, area damage, whatever the other extra
bits of the
combat are, and just run through that so you know it.
Again, when you're in the middle of a battle or a fight or trying to stay alive, yeah. to have pause, let me conduct a little bit of research, just kills the moment, especially when it is generally a tense life or death kind of moment, especially in something like Call of Cthulhu, where chances are someone's going to die. So to have that experience broken by reality is not ideal.
And I keep actually meaning to do this, even now, three games in, because I'm still not that great with the rules. Prepare. You don't rely on yourself being able to actually wing it.
Yeah.
If you are able to wing it, it's going to be because you're prepared.
Yeah.
So read the entire adventure, right? Read it once, all the way through from start to finish, and then read it again and make notes as you go. And that'll just pay huge dividends.
Yes.
And as you do that, this brings me into number five. As I do that, I like to pre-prepare character dialogue. Because just give myself little rough scripts
yes.
to read, because it's just one less thing that I have to think of. And when I've got the luxury of sitting there with a gin and tonic making up stuff that my main yes. antagonist is going to say,
like Henri is here.
If you like to write, it's just and I think a lot of GMs, DMs enjoy that creative process.
Yes,
it's a good way to write without foisting a whole bunch of exposition and description onto your players, and to get them to have to sit there and listen to you just read off paragraphs of shite.
Mm-hmm.
All right, you know, write some snappy dialogue.
Yep. I loved actually the second time we came across Bentley Burnham from Birmingham.
Birmingham.
For the reporter. And you
well,
know
well he said he was a reporter.
Yeah, and you know what I loved about him was he had an answer for everything, the smart aleck.
That's right.
And it was clearly not that, you know, I believe so. You weren't making this up off the cuff. You had a story just like he did. He had his story pre-prepared. Jesus.
Yeah.
He had his story ready. And, yep. You know, when we asked our questions, he fired the answers back.
Correct. And again, it just makes the experience so much better. So are we up to six now?
Consider saying yes to your players when they ask for something stupid.
We don't ask for stupid.
Still waiting on a Star Wars jetpack.
But don't be afraid to say no either. And what that means is that a bit like I said to you earlier, Mark, a good player is always going to surprise you, I think.
Yes.
Because they'll bring their own idea. I mean, you've got your own idea of who your character is, how heroic they are, maybe some things that they want to achieve. And it's up to me or anyone who's running a game to facilitate that. But if they then stray too far into making stupid demands
yes.
and trying to bend the rules in an unfair way to their own advantage.
Oh, you're looking at me.
Then just say no.
Well, I was going to say, I think the classic example of this is, you know, Garth saying, okay, I'm going to call ahead to the next station where we'll be in 3 or 4 hours, and I'm going to ask them to hand make a fez that matches this one perfectly in every way, and no one will ever know the difference.
Considering it's 1890 something, so trying to explain that to someone over Morse code.
Yeah, that's right. We'll telegraph ahead.
And what's Morse code for Pantone Red 320?
And you just say, no.
But I got my fez.
You did, yeah.
And it saved your life.
Well, that's right, because we put it over top of my fez.
Put it over the top of your real fez.
What are you up to, seven?
Yeah.
Knowing some of the conventions of storytelling and drama, I find has been really, really... And I was lucky enough to sort of study this while I was at uni as well. So understanding things like conflict, the importance of what's at stake, little tools like foreshadowing, red herrings, the rule of threes, the unity of opposites... Joseph Conrad's hero's journey. Am I getting a little bit too intellectual?
No.
For, I mean, that's the underpinning of everything that Star Wars is about.
Yes.
Okay, those aren't just rules for storytelling. They're actually tools for telling the story that you want. They're archetypes, dramatic archetypes that you can deploy when you need them, and people unconsciously recognise them.
Yes.
Yeah, and they're comfortable because you realise that this is the kind of adventure or the story that we're going to have. And it also helps that you personally take a great amount of joy in reading books and watching movies.
Exactly, yes.
That exhibit a whole bunch of those traits.
That storytelling is the joy of it.
Oh, yeah. We're getting to the pointy end. We must get number 9 or number 8?
Number 8.
Ooh.
One word, verisimilitude.
Is that a Kevin Rudd word? Or is that perspicacity? Or
the appearance of being real.
Yes.
All right, so...
How I live my life.
It's not that everything in your RPG has to be realistic. It's that it has to have an internal logic and consistency to it. Otherwise, you're just making things up.
Yeah. So it has to be believable.
Yeah. So
that this may be a fantastical scenario.
That's right.
But I can believe that this person would be carrying this particular thing at this particular time because it fits in with the story and it makes sense.
There is a universe where magic works, but it works the same way all the time for everybody. So that's what I mean. Yeah. So just apply that consistently. Number 9, reward good play with experience.
Yes.
Because, you know, you've got to give a dog a bone.
Exactly. And that's experience points as well as experience in the game.
And number 10, know when to call it a night.
Well, the only thing I wanted to ask you before we go to a bit of a musical break is how do you deal, because this happens, with RPG players who want to play it like a board game with a confined rule set and don't handle when things don't go the way that they, as a board gamer, think they should?
The short answer...
Yep. Kill them off.
Is that you don't invite them back?
Okay.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. It's a different thing,
mm-hmm.
and you have to surround yourself with players who are in the right mindset to do it, and who are going to at least buy in a little bit to the conceit of it. And it is a type of conceit.
Totally.
It's a shared storytelling experience, and the rules. I mean, the rules are there, and there is that consistency that's there. But the it's greater than the sum of its parts.
Mm.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, yeah. And look, this is somewhere where I definitely would take my my hat off to Dice Woman Tanya, who, as we know, runs the sessions in a local establishment where new people can come along and try it out. Because you've got no idea who's going to turn up. I mean, she will have a dialogue with them via social media, usually to sort of set the scene. But you don't know what this person is going to come along and be like in real life during the play. So, I mean, that doing that takes cojones.
And she's a braver man than I am. Absolutely.
Whereas, Trent, you, my friend, you are...
Sorry, Garth, contain yourself.
Okay.
I've got a feeling, I'm just sensing, there might be a segue into a song here.
Okay.
Oh, I'm sitting back with my cocktail in my comfy lounge, thinking about Trent. You are a joker, that's for sure.
The only thing Mark prepared for this show, and I use prepare very loosely, was his weekly segues, and you took that from him, Trent.
You bastard.
I know he thinks they're funny.
Well, anyway, that makes one.
That was the gimmicks. And, of course, you're back with The Dice Men Cometh on Edge Radio 99.3 FM. Now, Trent, not only have you been running this fantastic Cthulhu game...
Oh, shucks.
...but you've been building every man's dream, every geeky man's dream.
That's right, Kelly LeBrock. No, wait, that was a film I saw once back in the 80s. Yes, I am in the process of constructing my own man cave. And when I say constructing, I mean, of course, that I got somebody who knows what they're doing in, and I just sort of followed them around for a couple of days.
Gave them some money and
holding,
said, just do
holding nails and passing them tools and stuff like that. I've got a new room in my house that I am in the process of finding time to plaster, usually with a couple of drinks, so plastering while you're plastered.
And, sounds perfect.
Oh, my God. I came out of there completely covered head to toe in plaster dust the other night. And anyone who's done it will know it's like Martian dust. It's like it's so fine. It just sticks to everything. It's almost slimy. It's horrible. Terrible. And now I've got to put the bloody finishing plaster on, and then
boo-hoo, he gets carpet. A man cave, and it's all bad for Trent.
But I will say that the home theater system's already wired in, and there's going to be plenty of room for a nice big gaming table in the back there. I've got to get some shelves in, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's going to be a great space. I can't quite decide which way to go with the decor. Will I go to sort of plain white and basic, or will I fill it with sort of secondhand furniture and have a sort of
dark purples and reds and big wooden chunky furniture so you can sit in a corner have your, I don't know, a snifter of brandy?
Like a teenage drop-in centre run by a council with very few funds.
Or have relying a, have on, a you know,
tip shop furniture pickups.
Somewhere.
Yeah, and if I can find, you know, like a stained old cloth mannequin and park that in the corner.
Yeah, a deer head to hang your hats on.
Exactly. The point is, we need to know when we're going to christen this room with the first game, and it's got to be an epic game eventually, hasn't it?
Yeah, look, I'm thinking by mid-year it should be ready, just with finances permitting.
Of course.
Look, the truth is, though, that, you know, since I stepped away from this show and really for much of the last year, I've not really done that much gaming. My gaming stats have dropped off a cliff completely, and I'm hoping to get a little bit more back into it. So
you wouldn't want to any games of Seven Wonders at all then?
No. I did win one earlier in the year when I was on holiday.
That's in the last 12 months.
And I posted that on the Facebook page. But I don't really know what's up and current right now, to be honest, and what's new. I've got a copy of Pandemic Legacy like everybody else, but I've only played one game of it so far. So,
well, there you go. Yeah. Well, look, maybe you'd be interested, Trent, in the Board Game Geek Golden Geek Awards. I'm just going to have a quick skim over them because we only have a few minutes left. But look, a couple of interesting. Firstly, of course, Pandemic Legacy Season 1, right across the board, has just got so much attention. It won Board Game of the Year. It won Thematic Game. It won Strategy Game, interestingly. It won Most Innovative Game.
What?
Pretty much anything that it was in, it actually won. Unlike another game, which we loved, and we're about to post our latest play, Time Stories. Now, Time Stories won nothing, but it was second in artwork and presentation. It was second in innovative games. It was second in thematic games. So people sort of like it, but they don't love it. And everyone knows about it, I guess. There's a lot of talk. Seven Wonders Duel is the other one, which we've been waiting for the app to come out.
Really?
Seven Wonders Duel 1 won the two-player
game. Is that an expansion or a separate game?
No, so this is the separate two-player version, basically. So it won the best two-player game. It won the best card game. And that was all it won. But, you know, look, it was runner-up in Strategy Game of the Year.
That's pretty amazing, because that's a really small box game.
That's right. And look, everyone, of course, is waiting for the Seven Wonders app to come out. Mm-hmm. Look, a couple others of note. Mysterium featured strongly as well, winning up. So one artwork and presentation.
Honestly, Mysterium, in 5 years, who's going to care? It was runner-up, overrated.
I was going to say, it was runner-up in the party game. And in the family game categories. Now,
yeah, I guess I can see that.
I just don't think of it as a party game. Group game, yes, but not party game.
And similar family game, because there's no real text dependence unless you're the ghost and you'd have to massage the rules. But I can see that. I like the second edition more than the first edition. The English version, I think, just sort of fits a bit better for me.
Me too. A couple of others of note. Our good friends, Tasty Minstrel, Between Two Cities was runner-up in the Family Game of the Year.
Really?
Grizzled, which is one we're really interested in.
Everybody keeps talking about Grizzled.
It's on its way to me right now.
Yeah, it was the runner-up in the Card Game of the Year. 504. Now, we had a conversation recently about 504 by Freedom and Freeze, where should we get it? Because it's such a innovative game where it's more a box of tricks to make games than it is a game itself. Funnily enough, it was runner-up in the innovative games category, but it's got a lot of bad press.
How is that not more innovative? Sorry, so it came second to Pandemic Legacy, which is a game that's Pandemic's been around for years, and the Legacy mechanic has been around for a bit as well. So I don't know how Pandemic Legacy is considered so innovative.
Well, it's the game that people enjoy more, and 504 sounds like an innovative mechanic, but it also sounds like the sort of thing where you want to see that mechanic redeployed on something good.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, from what I've read, it's innovative, but none of the 504 games are particularly that amazing to play.
Yeah.
So you might end up playing two or three that are fun, but that's it.
Look, one final notable omission. We weren't in the best podcast category. We were nominated. We didn't feature in the finalist.
You lost your big gun, your big strength.
I think we'll close the show for today because we've run out of time. We will. Thank you so much for joining us. Thank you, Trent. We're off to the pub to play more games. You should do the same. Bye.
Bye.
This has been an edit of The Dice Men Cometh from Edge Radio 99.3 FM, Hobart's independent youth station. Find us on Facebook and edgeradio.org.au.